Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about the ramifications of the Wagner mutiny, which took place 1 year ago, and the death of Wagner leader Yevgeny Prigozhin in a suspicious plane crash 2 months later. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Kirill Shamiev, a fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and an expert on Russia and on civil-military relations. Thanks very much for joining me today, Kirill.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. First-time guest. I really appreciate your time. Now, this podcast is about Russia's war against Ukraine almost every week. Today, the war is closely related, but it is not the direct focus of the podcast. It's been 1 year since the Wagner mutiny, since forces from the mercenary group headed by Yevgeny Prigozhin crossed into Russia from Ukraine, where they were fighting, seized a Russian military headquarters in the southern city of Rostov-on-Don, and another group of them marched north toward Moscow. They were about 200 kilometers from the Russian capital when a murky deal was announced and Prigozhin called off the rebellion. 2 months later, Prigozhin was killed in a plane crash in Russia, whose cause has not been convincingly explained. Many believe that President Vladimir Putin had Prigozhin killed. Now, my first question is about what I would call the political ramifications of the mutiny. Let me just take us back to June 24th, 2023. It's hard to overemphasize how shocking this was, I think, to many people watching Russia. A mercenary force essentially seized control of a large Russian city and was headed toward Moscow. Now, Putin was not the direct target of the rebellion. Prigozhin, who had been complaining about the military leadership, for weeks or months, was calling for the ouster of Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, who is no longer in that post, and of General Staff Chief Valery Gerasimov, who remains in the General Staff, his post as head of the General Staff today. Despite speculation that he would also be on his way out. But in any case, Prigozhin's criticism was of the military leadership. Putin is the commander-in-chief, and this was a huge challenge for Putin. And I think the initial take by a number of analysts was that it was the beginning of the end for Putin, that is, that his authority was irreparably damaged, essentially. I think that assessment kind of changed with time, both before and after Prigozhin was killed in the plane crash on August 24th of that year, last year. Now, one year later, Putin obviously remains in power. He started a new six-year term in May. So basically, my question is, how big a deal, with hindsight, how big a deal was the mutiny, and is it likely to have long-term effects for Putin and for Russia?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that it's important to talk about the mutiny itself as an event separately from the aftermath of what happened in June last year. When it comes to the mutiny, it was an unprecedented, in my view, an attempt to overthrow the government and probably President Putin himself by Prigozhin. And this was unprecedented in Russia's history. This failed, but in that particular few days when it was happening, the Russian political system, but in general, I would say even the Russian state was balancing between having something of a civil war or revolution and what happened later, just the failure of the mutiny and strengthening of the regime. In my opinion, when it comes to these events in an authoritarian setting, it's bad when there is no revolution, right, in dictatorship, but it's even worse when it's a failed revolution, because then the state and the political regime learns from how different actors reacted, how the system performed, who did well, who did worse, and then the regime gets only strengthened because those allies and those who actually supported the incumbent, they get benefits, and those who did not, or drag their feet, they can have some negative repercussions against them. And this is what we've seen after throughout the year after the mutiny, basically from June last year to what's happening even now. Just a couple of days ago, I've seen some reports that actually some staff members of the so-called like Wagner media empire, or people who work for Prigozhin personally, they kind of start to disappear or end up in detention facilities. So the process is still going. But in terms of the events in June last year itself, we see that how the Russian state reacted and the elites reacted. Well, first, what was really surprising to me, apart from the mutiny itself, of course, that not a single member of the Russian elite immediately started to support Prigozhin. By Saturday night, several regional governors and federal elite members had publicly supported Putin. And this shows the limits of the opposition, at least last year, to Putin in the upper echelons of the Russian political system. Of course, some of them were just silent or dragged their feet, over expressing support. But still, the system remained. Some maybe left, in a hurry or tried to leave the country, fearing Prigozhin personally or the start of the shooting. But still, the system showed its support for the president. And second, what's important that it also showed, despite a huge military, so paramilitary force occupying the headquarters of the Southern Military District and going to Moscow, other security agencies and military formations, they remain under control of Moscow. Even some of them said, including to, I think, Ukrainian sources, they said that there was no significant development on the front line, although some Russian military bloggers said that some units had to be transported to urgently to Moscow to protect it, but still the military remained under the official Moscow's control. And this also showed that despite, and there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that the military actually, I think I wouldn't exaggerate to say that hated Minister of Defense Shoigu and detested the Chief of the General Staff Gerasimov for the failures in the full-scale invasion. Still, they said, okay, that's not our fight. It's a political development. And they had their commanders remained in position and waited for the orders. But on the other hand, what it did reveal, and that's why I think it's important that to acknowledge that the Moscow started to learn from this, that the state was actually very fragile. They did wait for central commands. It was for a couple of maybe up to 2 days, Russian security agents, especially in Rostov region and like along the roads to Moscow, were maybe in a state of frenzy. They just didn't know what to do. They only around Moscow, there's sort of an organized defense layer started to appear by the evening of next day. And this shows that there was no leader, no commander who could say, okay, I know what to do. And these are the insurrectionists, and we will fight to protect, the president or Russia. No, they were all waiting for the orders from the chief of the general staff, the president himself, or other senior officials before acting on their own. And this, again, is a great example of how super centralized the Russian system is. And if something goes bad there on top, somewhere in the Kremlin, then I cannot even imagine what can happen in terms of coordination and asynchronization of the Russian security system.
All right, thanks. You mentioned the fragility just now. That was revealed, real fragility of the state, I guess, and security apparatus. Would you say that this that a year later, that's like still a problem, like that it's more fragile or less so? And I guess a related question is essentially, again, I mentioned that, early assessments, I think, by many analysts were that this was really a problem for Putin, and he might be, it might end up with him essentially losing power. But obviously that hasn't happened. Do you think that the way this played out has made him stronger, has made him weaker, more vulnerable?
The short answer would be yes, in short term, Putin's regime has become stronger, but with very important nuance. The thing is that systemically, the system is still highly centralized, and this means highly fragile, because if there is no central leadership, this whole ultra-centralized system will basically have no one in command who would control and tell everybody else what to do, or there is no procedures or coordination mechanism that would tell, okay, these regional governors work know how to work with each other, and if something happens, Moscow disappears, they would still be kind of in control and know how to work. Well, this shows that because of this authoritarian system, and in my view, it gets even worse because of the transitioning to this personalist autocracy or personalist dictatorship, and Putin's ever-growing fear of unrest or a coup against him. We've seen evidence how someone reported that even inside Russia, Putin started to fly with fighter jets escorting his plane. And this shows his and probably his bodyguards' fear of potential, assassination or another coup d'etat attempt. That's again, kind of a good example of the fragility of this system. In terms of other cases, Moscow started to work on cleaning the military from any signs of high-level discontent or insubordination among the generals. They've got rid of several senior generals recently with the reshuffling of the Ministry of Defense. I think this process is still ongoing. We'll see more people removed or even put in jail, and new people appointed in their positions. They also sent some generals to Africa or to Syria, and just the rest remained silent. So there is still something happening on the surface, but there is even more happening behind the headlines. And this shows that they're still working on the lessons learned last year in June.
Okay, thanks. And sorry, one more follow-up question on this. Obviously the reason behind the mutiny or the background of it was that Prigozhin's forces were fighting in Ukraine and dying in large numbers, and he was recruiting inmates from prison and such. But you mentioned that both Putin and the government have cracked down essentially since, taken measures, learned some lessons. I'm just wondering if you think that such a thing, such an event, an insurrection or mutiny, is kind of possible. Is it possible that it could happen again, or and would that depend in part on how the war in Ukraine goes for Russia?
Yeah, there are still some stress factors or points of concern in my view. For example, still, what's important to see here when we discuss Wagner, that this private, so-called private military company, it was a completely novel development. This was outside the established institutionalized political and security system. They're sort of like informal group with lots of guns, logistically supported by the Ministry of Defense, and its senior mercenaries, and most of their mercenaries before the full-scale invasion had military or police experience, including special forces. And these groups still exist, but they are sort of fragmented. They're way more. It's more than 30 some investigative reporters discovered. They're each of them numerically, of course, smaller and less powerful than Wagner, how Wagner used to be, but they still exist. Some of them are funded and supported by the FSB, by the Ministry of Defense. Some even have closer connections with defense industries or, with the Moscow government, for example, or state corporations such as Rosneft, Gazprom, Alpha Bank, the Crimean government, for example, also. And there's smaller so-called private military companies, let's call them maybe private military groups. They still exist, and it's hard to, I mean, just institutionally, it's hard to control all of them, oversee them, especially, for instance, when the war ends, what these people would do, what kind of alliances they can sign, especially these people who are just, infantrymen, soldiers, what kind of skills they have. They don't have any other skills than working for people, in quote unquote, kill people and destroy things. And who would give them orders after the state tells, okay, we don't need you anymore? Well, they will go. And this is, I think, an important risk factor that we shouldn't, that we should acknowledge and monitor very closely. And I think Moscow actually also knows about it. That's why they significantly improved the military capabilities of Rosgvardia, Russia's internal military, we can say. They amended the law allowing them to receive heavy equipment, including tanks. And I think recently the head of Rosgvardia, Zolotov, he said that they received around 30 tanks, heavy tanks, and other artillery units, for example, in under their command. And this shows that, when an internal army has really heavy capabilities, they become quite a important and powerful counterforce to potential attempts to destabilize Russia again.
All right, thanks very much. My second question, or maybe it's the fourth or fifth question, is more about Wagner itself and what has become of it since the mutiny and since Prigozhin's death. There are kind of two strands here. One is that Prigozhin had been recruiting prison inmates in Russia to join Wagner and fight in Ukraine, and former members who have returned to Russia from Ukraine. Have carried out some vicious, violent crimes. So, is this one question? Is this kind of the specific legacy of Wagner, or is this violence a broader phenomenon? And the other strand is what really has become of Wagner? I realize this is a big topic, but just a few words maybe about, has it been subsumed into the state, essentially taken over by the military? And you mentioned, you mentioned the National Guard, Rosgvardia. And are there remnants of Wagner now fighting in Ukraine and operating abroad in Syria and in Africa?
Yeah, these are two big questions. I'd start with the first one. Well, in general, it's an international phenomenon when conflicts and veterans have problems. Tend to have, some of the veterans tend to have problems with law, with the you know with law, with the law, or drug abuse, substance abuse, or any other illegal activities or illicit substances. If you add to the list of veterans inmates, and some of them for absolutely horrendous crimes, sexual crimes, assassinations, murder, and so on, who spent, instead of, say, 20 years in prison, 2, 3 years in prison, then fought for 6 months in Ukraine, and they came as heroes, we can expect how this the impact of combat then this just their own criminal behavior and experience, both while conducting the crimes and also in prison, their connections in France were probably also more likely to be from the criminal background, and also alcohol abuse. So the third factor can lead to rise of crimes conducted by these people, and this would be a lasting problem for Russia, and unfortunately for just general bystanders, Russian kids, women, elderly, anyone else who will get in touch with them and can potentially become their victims. And this is, in my view, one of the crimes that Prigozhin started, but actually then Russia's Ministry of Defense officially continued, because now these inmates go, instead of Wagner, to Russian Ministry of Defense units, so-called Storm Z units, in the most harsh assault formations, detachments that are sent as the first line of attack against Ukrainian forces. And those who survive, they would be released and walk freely. And again, when it always comes to resocialization and integration of these people, what kind of skills do they have, especially if they spend years in prison and then several months or maybe a year, during the war, somehow luckily survive? What can they do in the labor market? Probably nothing. And what kind of income would they get? Well, we can only guess, but I'm quite pessimistic about their lives and the lives of people around them. So it's a huge problem for Russia. It's going to be years to come. Even, if the war ends tomorrow, we will still get, unfortunately, these news from maybe 10, 20 years, those veterans doing crimes again and again. Yeah, in terms of the what happened to Wagner itself, I'd say there are two main streams. On the one hand, the first stream is sending mercenaries and other people who decided to join them abroad. mostly to the African countries, Libya and the Sahel region, like there in the south. And this is most likely coordinated by the Russian Ministry of Defense and its main director, so-called the GU or GRU, the main intelligence directorate. And so there are some reports that probably Beg Yevkurov, Russia's, I would say, also a politician, but also a general as its head. And they provide security services to the local and regional governments. Some of them are official, fighting terrorists and separatists, but also some of just regime support, because most of these countries are heavily authoritarian, and the people in power need some foreign troops to stay in power and, to steal funds and wealth of these countries for longer. And Russian troops can have heavily experienced, committed to the mission. They will be a good support for these regimes there in those region, in that region. And another stream is what I've partially covered already in the responding to the previous question is those who join smaller private military groups under the so-called umbrella private military company Redut. And under these Redut, there are multiple smaller groups such as, Tigers, Wolves, Lystan, Troev, the veterans. They're multiple. You follow like Russian so-called Zat probe or Telegram channels, you can see even their, patches, and some of them have Telegram channels. So they operate as a semi-independent, but still under heavier Russia's Ministry of Defense control, basically fighting against Ukraine. So some of them joined these smaller private military groups. There are some reports that actually those, rank and file, ordinary so-called, enlisted mercenaries from Wagner, they also joined as soldiers in the Ministry of Defense positions, so like in the official army. And this is basically when their story ends, they become service members in the Russian military. But these two strands, I think, are the key. Those who are abroad and they operate outside of Russia's borders, or outside, let's say outside the Eurasian, outside the Russian and Ukrainian borders, and those who got integrated in smaller private military groups and the official Russian army.
All right, thanks very much. I'm just going to put in a little plug for my colleagues at RFURL. Did a great report on Redoute, which you mentioned several months ago. We're going to wrap it up here. Really appreciate your comments, your analysis. Thanks very much for joining me, Kirill.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, once again, I've been speaking to Kirill Shamiev, a fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, an expert on Russia and civil-military relations. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFURL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.